This is tape three, morning of October the 7th. All right, Mr. President, were you finished with General Jackson, the Battle of New Orleans?
I was discussing General Jackson at the Battle of New Orleans. And he was the commanding general of the troops, the American troops against the British in New Orleans. And he was the tough general that he always was as president and as a commanding general. He won the Battle of New Orleans by the approach which he made. He set up cotton bales as a defense, and when the British landed, he had his men so trained, and they were all good shots, that they slaughtered them in wholesale. I think there were a tremendous number of British soldiers killed at that battle, including the Pakenham, who was the commanding general. He was a lord or a duke or something of the kind at that period. But when they went to ship his body, he was killed there, went to ship his body back to Britain, according to a story which I've heard at the White House. They pickled him in alcohol and tied a barrel of alcohol in which he was pickled to the mast. And the common soldiers down below found out that there was a barrel of alcohol attached to the mask, so they took a gimlet and bored a hole into it and got the alcohol out and drank it. And Pakenham was not in any condition to be buried when he got back to England. That's a story told to me by Franklin Roosevelt.
What was the source of the story, Mr. President? It's an interesting anecdote.
President Roosevelt at the White House told me that story.
He didn't say where he'd gotten it, or just...
No, it was a good story anyway, whether it's true or not.
Think it was an invention of his own, or just...
No, I don't. I think it probably was true. I don't think there's any doubt if these sailors had found out there was a barrel of alcohol attached to a mask on the main deck, that they wouldn't have hesitated to pour holes in to get the alcohol.
It's probably one of those Navy stories, scuttlebutt.
That's what it is, scuttlebutt. It's a good story anyway, whether it's true or not.
Probably has to do with the importance of embalming fluid, or you shouldn't use alcohol for embalming fluid.
That's the only way they could preserve him, get him back home and bury him in the one of the honors to which he was entitled.
Well, all in all, you would rate Madison as an adequate president for his period, but having a far greater capacity than he exhibited as president.
He would have been a great president had there been no war. As a war president, he was a failure. I think as a president in a peacetime, he would have been a great president, because he had some wonderful ideas as expressed in the Federalist and in his papers, which are still available in the Library of Congress.
Now, Dolly Madison cut quite a swath through Washington when she presided over the White House, did she not?
Well, yes, but her great period was after she left the White House. She was the social head of the Washington setup for a long time after she left the White House, I think through all the way through the Jackson administration. Dolly Madison was the social head of things in Washington.
So what do you think of the social heads, these ladies, throughout the history in Washington, to the present day?
They're necessary because foreign governments are very much intrigued with social affairs. And one of the duties of the President of the United States is to act as the social head of the state. And in doing that, he gives receptions and dinners and entertainments. And it's a privilege to anyone to be invited to the White House as a guest of the President at any of these functions. And these functions are usually held for the entertainment of the heads of states who are friendly with us, and for visiting men who are high socially and politically in other countries. It's a necessary program that has to be carried on. And in the days of Dolly Madison, it was much more important than it is now.
Well, I was referring specifically to these great ladies who held great social events, who had nothing to do with the government, although the government was invited, as well as foreign visitors.
Oh, well, there's always been some rich dowager in Washington who likes to hold dinners and functions of that kind Ellen Walsh McLean is the most outstanding one that I know of. And Mrs. Kafritz now, I think, has taken over since Ellen Walsh died. And they have great functions at their places, and they're very interesting, and there are always a lot of senators and representatives. And the president usually doesn't attend functions of that kind, because when he wants to put on a function, and nobody can put on a function for the president except the president himself, they're usually held at the White House. But those functions are very interesting and entertaining. When I was the United States Senate, I used to attend them and had a good time there.
Well, were they useful at all, Mr. President?
They were useful because it gives people a chance to associate with each other and discuss situations. I think one of the contributions to the bipartisan foreign policy of the United States was Evelyn Walsh McLean's entertainments and dinner during that period.
But the White House does it mostly as an obligation. It's very formal and isn't conducive to any negotiations or discussions. It's purely social.
Well, it's not purely social. The discussions take place in the Red Room, in the Green Room, in the East Room, on all those functions. They're bound to. Whenever men of different interests are socially associated, they always eventually discuss what's going on and hope that something will happen to their interest and benefit. That goes on at the White House as well as any other social function.
Well, it's another way to get at the person of the president if they can catch him.
Well, the president, when a social function in the White House, at least when I was there and when Roosevelt was there, after the social function was over, the president would usually sit around the table and talk 15, 20 minutes with the men who were at the function. Then he'd leave, and it was up to them to have their own association. No one ever, while Roosevelt was there, while I was there, ever had any opportunity to discuss political matters or social or foreign affairs matters with the president at the White House, unless he wanted to do it. Sometimes he'd have a small luncheon to discuss these things, but at the social functions, which are the great social functions, the president was never available for conversation on that subject, although the guests could associate with themselves and discuss anything they wanted to.
Who were usually the guests? Were they foreign dignitaries?
Foreign dignitaries in the instances where foreign heads of state were there, and the leading senators and representatives, the chairman of committees, and the minority members of committees were always at these functions.
I noticed where Dolly Madison was even voted a seat in the House of Representatives when she visited the gallery at one time, and she became a member of the House of Representatives.
An honorary member.
That an honorary membership?
An honorary membership. She couldn't be made a member of the House of Representatives, but she was made an honorary member of the House of Representatives.
Has that been done since?
Not that I know of.
Was that, in your judgment, a stretching of the point a little bit?
No, I don't think so. She was a great lady, Dolly Madison was, and she was also held functions at her house on the same order as these other great hostesses have, and a great many things were transacted at those functions that otherwise would never have been discussed. And I think it was an honor that she was entitled to.
Would you rate her as the most glamorous of the first ladies?
Yes, I would. Yes, she was the most glamorous.
Of course, excluding Mrs. Truman.
Well, Mrs. Truman never had any idea of being glamorous.
Well, Mrs. Truman, I may add parenthetically here, is held in very high esteem and affection by the people of the country for the very reason that she had practice such restraint and such withdrawal from being prominently identified.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. Now, the First Lady, who is the most nearly, can be most easily compared with Dolly Madison, is Mrs. Franklin Roosevelt, who, because of Franklin Roosevelt's physical disability, acted for him in a great many instances in the position that he would have taken under ordinary circumstances. She's, Mrs. Roosevelt's a great lady, and she has been exceedingly well thought of, both in foreign affairs and domestic affairs, and I think she comes more nearly being analogous to Dolly Madison and any other first lady that's ever been in the White House.
Yet,
how much influence did these ladies have in appointments or in policy or in anything which would affect the president or any part of the government?
Well, in policy, I think they had a great deal of influence. In appointments, I don't think they paid much attention to that.
They did have influence in policy making.
In policy matters, because they made reports to the president and discussed with him those things. Mr. Roosevelt always discussed his policy matters with Ms. Roosevelt. And in a great many instances, she made foreign trips and trips over the United States to furnish him with information on which he could completely rely.
But Mrs. Roosevelt was uniquely equipped as a social service worker before the presidency or even before the governorship, so that she had a special vocation there.
Well, she was a Roosevelt, and she was always interested in public affairs, and that's the reason that came about.
And temperamentally, she was a person that took charge.
She was a Roosevelt. She was a sixth cousin, I think, Franklin, and I'm not sure that she wasn't the first cousin of Teddy.
Well, just to throw back a little bit, Monroe showed. Well, let's keep Monroe out because we're going to get to him. But other presidents were very sensitive about that thing called nepotism. In the early stages, Washington made comment on Adams's situation. And
but he wanted to appoint Washington's brother to be to the High Court. That's right.
But went ahead and did it anyway. And John Quincy Adams in his post to pressure and the recall of him.
That's right.
And yet we are now seeing, or we have been seeing, an intrusion of a president's family in some instances upon the White House itself and upon other activities. And parenthetically, we're about to see it again, maybe. Well, how do you feel about that?
Talking about Eisenhower.
I'm talking about Roosevelt, because the sons were in there. All the son was there as
secretary,
and Mrs. Roosevelt was doing many things. Anna came in later on, and she was with him for 2 years. Went with him to Yalta.
She was a secretary.
Now, in the case of Eisenhower, his son and his brother. And in case of the Kennedys, we now see the thing quite open. How do you feel about all this?
Well, it's brought about in this way. A president always has the most difficult time finding people that he can trust implicitly. And it's a difficult situation, naturally. And some of the presidents have felt that their sisters and their cousins and their aunts were more likely to be trustworthy and loyal to them than any outsider that they might bring in. It was always my opinion that while good men are difficult to find and are not always available when you need them, it is much better to go outside the immediate family relationship in order to have advisors and men who you designate for our responsible positions. That's just an opinion of mine, but I still think it's a good one, because while most people always think of their relatives first, even corporations, you find that there's more nepotism than any other place in the whole history of the world, they still don't like to see their public officials put their sisters and their cousins and their aunts in places of responsibility.
Mr. President, this is the end of tape 3, October the 7th, and we'll go back to that in a moment.
Yes.
This is tape 4 of the morning of October the 7th. You were talking about this whole problem of nepotism.
Well, they call it nepotism. It's a problem of using a family connection for places of responsibility and the operation of the government of the United States or a state or a county or anywhere else. And it's carried on all the time, not intermittently, but it's been carried on ever since any government was organized. In the old tribes, the chief's family was the one on which he relied most to get things done the way he wanted them. And that's a thing that's descended in the line of government all the way through. But in this modern time of free government, I think it's much better for a man in charge of the places of responsibility to try to find people who are best qualified for those positions, and eventually he'll find people he can trust. Hardest thing in the world is to find a man you can trust, but there are such men, and I know they can be found. And it's always better to keep the government of the United States as a free government without the idea of organizing a dynasty of one family to run the government.
Well, you are regarded as one of the most family-minded of our presidents and one of the closest to his immediate family. Did you use the family for any policy-making conferences, or did you check with the family any of the decisions you made?
No, I didn't. I didn't use the family in official capacity in any way, whatever. Mrs. Truman and I used to discuss things that came up and consider them, but that was all in the family and was not in an official capacity. Her judgment has always been good, and her judgment was for the welfare and benefit of the country, not necessarily for my promotion. But you don't find very many families as closely knit as mine was who did not try to take a hand in government. None of my family ever interfered with what I was trying to do as a public official, even from the time I was county judge all the way through my career.
And when you talk about family dynasties, what you mean is family dynasties as of the moment, because there's no way of passing on the influence of the dynasty when the head of the family
is. No, but the most outstanding example of that situation in the United States is the Adams family and the Harrison family and the Roosevelt family. But of course Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt were cousins and in opposite parties, but then it was a dynastic, really a dynastic program, because the great name of Roosevelt was an asset to anybody who wanted to run for office. And I've never believed in that. I don't think that's right and proper.
You think it ought to be discouraged, then?
I think it ought to be discouraged. I don't think it's a good thing, because first thing you know, we can go back to the very thing that the revolutionary was fought for, was to prevent a dynastic government with a head of state who inherits it.
Even if you have to pass up probably some very talented and skilled men.
No, I wouldn't say that. If a man's got the ability and knows how to do the job to make a difference what his connection is, he ought to be considered for it, just as Washington had to consider his brother for the Supreme Court.
But you do not think there ought to be a dynasty?
No, I don't. I don't think there ought to be a dynasty in a Republican form of government. That is the government of a republic, let's put it that
way. Well, with that, can we now go over to another president, President Monroe, and see what your profile of President Monroe is. We're all right?
Sorry, it's all right, fine.
Under Monroe, the inauguration of a president was staged outdoors for the first time in order to avoid some embarrassment with both branches of the House. Do you know what that is, sir?
No, I'm not familiar with that. Since that time, the inauguration has been held on the front portico of the Capitol building, and that may have had some. There may have been some concrete reason for that, because the vice president is always inaugurated in the Senate, because he's the presiding officer of the Senate. And I think up to the time of Monroe, the presidents had been inaugurated in the House of Representatives. But it was a good thing, I think, to have the inauguration for before the public out in front of the Capitol.
Well, you're quite right. There was some controversy about the distribution of seats as between the representatives and the members of the Senate.
Yes, that's right. Well, there's no controversy when you have it out on the front porch.
They use the inaugural ceremony as a platform from which a president declared or presented the policies which were to guide his administration?
Yes. His inaugural address was supposed to outline the program which he had in view for his administration.
That's in the same spirit it was started by the first president.
That's right.
And when did the State of the Union message begin? That was part of the constitutional provision, was it not?
Yes, the Constitution provided that the president should inform the Congress on the State of the Union, which he does once a year. But he has a half a dozen messages that he sends in connection with that.
Was it a pretty formal and weighty document in those days, or was it just...
Oh, yes, a very formal document, and it outlined the program which the president hoped to put into effect.
Pretty much in the same extent that it is in these times?
That's right. It hasn't changed much through the whole time, the period.
Do you know why it was necessary to draft a document on the State of the Union then?
Because the Constitution provides for it, and the people who wrote the Constitution thought that the legislative branch, the government, ought to be informed on what the president wanted to do.
Judge, Dr. Holmes, now being talked to you now.
Sure.
President, question, I'm at, I mistakenly asked about Madison. In internal politics, during the time of James Monroe, the fact that there hadn't been any electoral college contest gave, as historians called this era, a picture of the era of good things.
Good feeling.
Good feeling, rather.
The era of good feeling, that's
yes.
Right.
What is your opinion about this era of
well, the era of good feeling came about due to the fact that the political opposition to the Virginia dynasty had broken up. There wasn't any. And then that situation was overcome when Jackson ran for president in 1824 and was defeated by the fact that the presidential election went into the House of Representatives at that time, the second time that had happened. And I think there were four candidates who were considered by the House of Representatives. And it was claimed that Clay made a deal with John Quincy Adams and overcame Jackson they elected John Quincy Adams as president, and Henry Clay became his Secretary of State. And then Jackson was the candidate in 1826, I think it was, and was elected president of the United States. And then he organized the Democratic Party, which threw the nomination of the president out of the House of Representatives and into a convention, which has been the policy ever since of the Democratic Party. And that ended the so-called era of good feeling.
Let's get at a couple of incidents here that are rather important in the Monroe administration. One was the Missouri Compromise occurred right during his administration. That was the problem between Missouri and Maine.
Yes, that was the compromise in the admission of states. It was always a controversy as to the admission of states from north and south of the Mason-Dixon line. And Missouri was admitted to offset the admission of Maine. Maine was a part of Massachusetts at that time. And when Maine was admitted, Missouri was supposed to be admitted at the same time. I think Maine finally was admitted in 1818. And the controversy continued. And then the Missouri Compromise came about, and Missouri was admitted in 1820. And the southern boundary of Missouri, which is latitude 3630, was made the boundary between free and slave territory in the United States.
Excuse me, may I correct that? Maine was admitted in 1820.
It was supposed to have been admitted in 1820, but Maine was voted in 2 years before Missouri was, but was never formally admitted until they obtained the Missouri Compromise.
Yet, at the same time, there was an established colony in Upper Guinea in West Africa by the American Colonization Society, what do they call them?
Yes,
for Negroes?
Monrovia.
And they named the capital city for President
James
Monroe.
Called
it Monrovia.
Monrovia, that is Liberia.
Liberia. Yeah,
that's right.
Now, why this? So while we were compromising in Missouri, we were trying as a people to make some amends, even at that time, for the mistreatment or misappropriation of Negroes?
No, it was the intention to prevent further slave trade. The idea was to prevent, you see, the Massachusetts people sold, the New Englanders sold all their slaves to the South, and then they were the importers of the slaves, and it was hoped when the Constitution was adopted that the slave trade would be stopped in 1809. It never was stopped. And it was too bad that that situation had to develop in the Western Hemisphere. It should never have developed. That's what really wound up. And the cause of the Missouri Compromise and the Compromise of 1850 and then the War of 1861 was the result of that slave business.
Well, there was never a period since the founding of the United States when some important element of our population was opposed to the doctrine or the theory of Negro slavery.
That's correct, and they were opposed to slavery as an institution. And Jefferson was violently opposed to it and released all his, freed all his slaves when he died.
How about President Monroe and slavery? Do you have any recollection of
his
position?
I have no idea of what his position was. I don't think there's any record of it. It wasn't a controversial proposition at that time.
No, we're unable to find it, but in terms of his personal disposition, because they did honor him in Liberia by calling the capital city Monrovia, there may have been some expression of feeling on his part of sympathy for the freedom of the...
I think there was expression of sympathy on his part for the establishment of a republic for freed slaves of the United States. I think that's how it came about. But I think Monroe was really a slave owner before he went through.
Was this Liberian settlement in cooperation with any other foreign power, European powers?
No, nothing I know of. At that time, Africa wasn't considered worth anything to anybody.
Just open land.
It's open land.
Well, wasn't Monroe, Master Jimmy, as he was called, virtually dependent upon his father for support until he was about 50 years, and then when his father died, he left him, I think, about 100 slaves.
I think that's true, and he left him a great estate in Virginia. He was entirely destitute when he came out of the presidency and lived with his daughter in New York until he died.
Well, Monroe, as a person, was slow of development. He didn't mature very early in life. That's the point you're trying to make. He took him.
Oh, no. He was mature, all right, but
he was a colonel in Washington's army.
He didn't have the financial support of him.
He was a colonel in Washington's army.
Yes.
Maybe his military training. Maybe his military training prevented his financial success.
That's probably what did happen.
And so that as a president, you would place him in a rather indifferent category.
That's right, along with James Madison, several others.
In spite of his association with the Monroe Doctrine.
That's right. That's the only great thing he did.
All right, this word.
All right, this is the end of tape for the morning of October the 7th.
No, I'm going to get you.